When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
To the town of Enniscorthy on Easter Sunday 1916, the countermanding order brought confusion and bitter disappointment, as it did to every part of Ireland where the rising was made ready. But early on the following Thursday, Enniscorthy did rise. The volunteers held the town until Sunday night, when, on Pearse's direct order, they agreed to lay down their arms. Those are the bones of the story. But for the flesh and blood of it, the heart and mind and memory of it, we must listen to the men of Enniscorthy themselves.
Well, my grandfather, James Tompkins, was a Fenian, and he was ready with his Snyder to take part in the 67 Rising. My mother, she could sing a song fairly good, and she sang all Irish songs and often told me she was very proud of her father.
That was Jack Whelan. His fellow volunteer, Jack Breen, remembers his school days and an old Christian brother, Mr. Norris.
He used to come around occasionally when he had retired and take five or six of us down to the end of the school, away from the rest of the pupils, and lecture us on nationality, Battle of Vinegar Hill, and fighting in 98, and what the people went through and all that. We were very fond of Vinegar Hill. I think everyone from the town of Enniscorthy remembers the old hill, no matter where they go. And we often went up there, I remember well, the place that we used to call the Croppy's Grave. And we used to think at least that the ground was spongy under our feet there.
Small wonder that so many of the young men of Enniscorthy joined the Gaelic League.
August we could mash andina lesh. We dina untak awan. Ada Blackham, vishishin awan an orod, vishagubber in Machala.
Enniscorthy echoes.
Ti the oishinod, far more gaelge lesh, shemus machinrachtery. A four boss in the year, and shows up Oshinoid, August Dina Marid.
August Arno, near a vein, Quivne, a rain, Gaelic Duchish, the counter Sanaum.
Ah, near Rev. Octavana Dina Hanigis Chacha, and a moon of Gaelic and on moon of Skulle.
That was Michal O'Kirawine. Another young fellow, Michal McKeochie, could never understand why a hall which bore the sign Gaelic Athletic Association was frequented by a number of elderly men.
We often laughed amongst ourselves as unthinking youngsters about those old grey-haired and bald-headed athletes, how they can't be connected with the association, to be regarded as members of the Gaelic Athletic Association. But of course, in later days, we really discovered the reason. George Keegan of Enniscorthy, who had been a Fenian, closely identified like many members of the Keegan family with the National Association, national activities all down the years, was Wexford's first member of the GAA, representing GAA and County Wexford rather, on the Gaelic Athletic Association. And he attended the famous Congress in Thurles, which had been described as the Fenian Congress. Now, those men who had been early associated with the Gaelic Athletic Association still resorted to and had a meeting place of their own in the this building, which came afterwards to be known as Antwerp.
On a night when the Slaney flooded high, one wet conspirator who had been reading his news of the war in Belgium said, "Sure, we might as well be in Antwerp." And Antwerp remained the name. It was a place where the right hand was not always aware what the left hand was doing exactly.
You don't him good Higgamer Gulair and made a veer, she will know, and dare a verklish. Could they go hanig shocked in a casket? Gimmer's cohog son, August Tasagot, Gimmer, Tagus, Reinkegs, Marchen.
Sooner or later, most of the young brotherhood of O'Growney students and hurlers became members of the older brotherhood. Dennis O'Brien recalls,
"I was in the IRB about 1910 or 1911.
You were a very young fellow then.
I was 26. And there was great activity organising the IRB. And we had a number of circles in Enniscorthy. Nearly everybody, every young fella that was thought likely to join was canvassed. And a lot did join."
Now, there were many roads into the movement. How did you come in, Paddy Pearce?
When I was a very young boy, I went to work in the Aco Printing Works at the age of 13 years. And it wasn't very long there when I discovered that there was a great national spirit in the place, and that most of the members were involved in the members of the IRB at that time. And we had already formed a branch of the Na Fianna Éireann.
For some years, Fianna boys from Dublin had been coming down regularly to camp on Vinegar Hill. Example was better than precept. The Enniscorthy Echo, by the way, did indeed play a very important part in the prehistory of 1916. As Bill Quirk says,
"Which was more or less the headquarters of the national movement at the time."
Or was Antwerp the HQ? Or the house of that dedicated family, the Keegans, where 98 and 67 lived into 16 and beyond? They all played their part and joined with enthusiasm in the founding of the Irish Volunteers, which Seamus O'Doyle recalls.
"We were founded here on the last Sunday in December 1913. O'Rahilly and M.J. Judge addressed the meeting, and Thomas Hayes, who was then chairman of the Enniscorthy Board of Guardians, presided at the meeting. A lot of people handed in their names, a lot of young men that day. We had a company based on Mary Street. There was a company in the Shannon, and there was a fragment of companies in John Street and in Irish Street. Of course, we organised the country places as well."
Well, now, were these companies, in theory at least, belonging to a larger brigade, to a Wexford brigade? Or...
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I was adjutant of the Wexford Brigade, and P.P. Galligan was brigade vice commandant. We hadn't ever a brigade strength, but we believed that an initial success would have augmented our ranks and that we would have had a brigade.
Now, was the split between, the Redmondite split, did this affect you much in Wexford generally and here?
Oh, well, they had more than we had.
In Enniscorthy or in Wexford in general?
And over the county in general. It was about 4,000, I think, before the split. I think that was the full strength of the volunteers before the split, but after it, I don't know how many remained with the original provisional council.
Did the split cause a great break among friends?
It did at first. It did at first. It had a very serious break, and there was a bit of hostility existed between the two groups. And now, then at the date of the actual raising, I'd say most of them turned out with us.
Pikes and guns, says the ballad man, were dangerous toys, but they could be useful. And since guns were scarce, Pierce called for pikes. And where would this call be answered if not in the town by Vinegar Hill? Jim Cleary got to work. He had just set up as a blacksmith.
There were very good business in the time, shoeing artists. Well, I had anything I'd done, I had to do it on the quite. You seen the pike? Well, them are welded between the hook and between the socket. Well, what I did, I made all the sockets. I could make them any time in the day. Nobody knew what they were. In fact, there were a man asked me one time, a very loyalist. Nearly all my customers were loyalists, you know. There weren't many farmers at the time, big ones anyway, but was loyal. And he asked me what they were, and I told him they were sockets for slash hooks. But I had a couple of good men, the best. Bailey Murphy and Jack Chart. One of them would go, there's an archway going up to it before you go. One of them would go down to the bottom and stop on the yard, and myself and the other fella start making the blade and welding up the socket to him. Night after night. Some nights nearly all night. Well, eventually anyway, apart from making pipes, we start making moulds. Making moulds for making buckshot. And you wouldn't make any great noise making the buckshot. Well, we worked very often all night at that. And we worked beyond Nantrop at the same job. And worked all night and went to 7 o'clock most of a Sunday morning.
When you were making the pike itself, how did you know about the shape of a pike and the making of a pike?
Well, I saw 298 pikes with a man named James Tompkins. Lived near Ballycarney. I came back with the idea in my head.
Well, the pikes you made were certainly as good, I suppose, were they, as the old ones?
As the 98 ones. I think they were better. They wouldn't break anyway. There were the best of steel in them. Well, now, that time the steel was there for springs, for ornery cars. You wouldn't weld spring steel to coat in motor cars, you know. Not in a fire anyway.
Well, was there any suspicion of the work you were doing, or did people know what you were at all?
Not the slightest. Because we had a real good crowd. They were all dead too. The working party was a great party.
What used she talk about those evenings?
Originally. Yeah. Well, you were not known only rebel songs and anybody that looked for a song that was one with blood and murder in it.
What were the songs they sang?
Oh, every rebel song that ever was printed, I think. Father Murphy and John Kelly Killan and all such, down along, Robert Emmett and Michael Dwyer and all the rest of them.
How much of this was just young men looking for something to do, and how much of it was more than that?
There was none of it looking for something to do, because Pat Keegan instilled it into you night and day what you were fighting for. He told you why you were making those things, and he never tired telling you.
And what did he say?
He told us of all the atrocities of 98 and all that kind of thing.
There were many jobs to be done, and many jobs were done. Phil Murphy was in the post office.
As well as being a rural postman, I used to have to do indoor duty as well. But I wasn't paid for the indoor duty. See, I was doing that now for the love and honour. At that time, then, they say I had a certain amount of freedom that the ordinary man wouldn't have. I could go up to the telegraph room and get these code messages, do you see, and bring them out. And the last transaction that I had with regards to a code message, I couldn't get this code message this day. And I knew it was in the Dublin bag, of course. The messages always go in what they call brown envelope, the accounts. And I thought to myself that, well, if I could manage it at all, I get it out of the bag. Well, I happened on the late Senator Keogh. And I said to him, will you come over to the old station before the goods go out? I want to do a bit of a job. Of course I will, said he. So I took next to lead seal. That time we were using lead, but prior to that you'd be having sealing wax. And a string went over to the station, took out the Dublin bag, brought it into the waiting room, opened it, and we two candles, and I was afraid of my life, let the candle grease drop on the old message, and all the fat would be in the fire, of course. But no, we escaped well.
Pierce was a frequent visitor to Enniscorthy in those days, but two visits above all stand out especially in Micheál McCaughey's memory.
I can vividly recall his reviewing of the County Wexford Irish Volunteers in the barley field underneath Vinegar Hill in October 1915. Again, on the 7th of March 1916, he gave a wonderful oration at the Robert Emmet commemoration concert in Enniscorthy. And I can well recall on that occasion his words to a packed hall, where he referred to the blood of Emmet trickling down the gullies. He also said, a blood sacrifice may be necessary again for Ireland, so that she may take her place amongst the nations of the earth.
Micheál McCaughey was then in command of the Fianna Boys, and at a volunteer meeting on Spy Wednesday night, he knew that something was going to happen very soon.
I can well recall a man named Jim Jordan, a carpenter and a very loyal member of the Irish Volunteers. He hailed from the Duffery country, from Monbeg, Ballindagan, putting a question. Well, boys, he said out loud, if the day comes, are we all willing to strike? And of course, he was greeted with cheers.
Seamus O'Doyle was in Dublin on Good Friday, and he knew that all was ready.
There's a kind of Sean McDermott, nothing serious. Don't tell him, sir.
The spirit was high, but it was cruelly wounded on Sunday. Canon Pat Murphy, a pioneer of insurgents from the beginning, remembers.
I was on the bridge of Enniscorthy, and the volunteers were down at a place called Antwerp, ready to go out. And many of the townspeople came along and they saw the volunteers and said, no, what are those fellows doing down there? I said, they were ready for a route march. Ready for a route march. And then about 2 o'clock, we already knew from the newspaper, I think, that the old Magia countermanded the rising. But anyhow, from Dublin came Min Ryan, and she said, Mrs. Mulcahy. And they gave us the countermand. So we had a council of war at which 5 or 6 were assembled in Mill Park Road, and we decided not to go out.
There was confusion and disappointment. Ginger O'Connell was to have taken command of the action in Wexford and the neighbouring counties. But after much consultation, he had to advise the Enniscorthy men that if they went out, they would go out alone. And this is what eventually they decided to do. From Easter Monday, arms had been brought in, arms from the Hoth gunrunning had been brought in from Goree. And on Wednesday night, the final decision was taken by the officers. On Thursday morning, the men were called out.
We were called about 3 o'clock on that Thursday morning, before daylight appeared on the sky. And in the street where I lived, there was about 13 of us, the most active members. We were the first group to be called and to be armed. In fact, that was all the rifles that we had in that area. And they were hid in the mission house, in the garden of the mission house in the Shannon. And we went down there and we were given a rifle each. And we formed up then in the Shannon and we marched down and across the bridge and to Eyre Street first, to this Keegan's, this famous Keegan's place. And we proceeded from there over to the Athenaeum, which was already occupied by Seamus Dáil and by the quarter staff, you know.
I think it was Seamus Dáil that put me on the head of Castle Hill for the fire at the barracks. There was a policeman there firing, you see. So I fired some shots. He was in the barrack door, you see, and he was sniping and was coming very close to. He was firing at the corner, he was hitting the corner of the wall, firing a little to his right, I think. But two men then, Mick Call, I think, and Jack Bolf, went up around to the back of Bennett's Hotel, and they took a pot at him from there, and somehow or other there was a piece of the brick knocked out of the corner of the wall where he was, and he abandoned that post very quickly. And the next place he fired from was the top window, firing still up at Castle Hill. It stopped after some time and we learned that he had been wounded in the knee. He was Constable Grace. The thing was, he was the only one in the barracks apparently that wanted to do any shooting. There was no more shooting then.
Brief as the exchange of fire was, its meaning came through loud and clear.
Cole got in and placed and on knee, he got in and son got up in the bookly in our ear of cart. She adores him here now, not want to go she need and kid placed a gun a clusher in any scoring or knock a hook.
Enniscorthy Castle was occupied with the goodwill of the owner, and then a moment of glory, which Greta Comerford, Banny Gouil, recalls for Cumann na Mban and the women of Wexford.
Mrs. Bob Brennan and Marion Stokes and myself came together and pulled the cords that raised the flag on high. And there was a great cheer all over the town when we saw the flag flying.
The town as a whole was cooperative, or at the worst, not uncooperative. The public houses were closed, the gas supply was, by order of volunteer headquarters, kept in service. There was a pass system for those entering and leaving. Dennis O'Brien was in charge of transport. Most of the cars, of course, were commandeered.
Well, they were nearly all commandeered. I don't think any of us had a car. No, I don't think any of us had a car. But there were some of the lads, the drivers, were in the volunteer session with them.
Volunteer headquarters sent scouts around the outlying parishes and villages. All was quiet. One village, one ancient city, had already answered Enniscorthy's summons. Paddy Ronan of Ferns remembers.
We left Ferns on Tuesday morning about 10 o'clock and we marched to on towards Enniscorthy, and beyond Skerrawench we met another dispatcher that said we weren't to go into the town. So we stayed in Ballinahallan Wood all day, and it was raining all day. I know it was a fair day in Enniscorthy as well. But we stayed there all day until night and got nothing to eat either, but however. That night some of our fellows went into Enniscorthy anyhow, and we were told to disperse and go home. That annoyed us very much. But however, we went home anyhow, and we said we wouldn't go anymore until we were definite that there was a rising was going to take place. So on Thursday, got a dispatch from Enniscorthy that they had taken over in Enniscorthy and we were to go in. So then on Thursday evening, we mobilised and we went in. There was about 50 of us went in. And a few others who weren't available at the time came in afterwards. So we stayed in Enniscorthy and did the usual work that was to be done in Enniscorthy with regard to an insurrection. And on Friday, there was word that came into Enniscorthy that there were soldiers seen between Ferns and Camogie. So it was decided anyhow to take over Ferns as an outpost. So a good many Ferns fellows and a large portion of Enniscorthy fellows came back to Ferns, and we took over the RIC barrack there. The RIC had gone by the time we came back. They were there and we were going, but they had gone by this time. They went on to Gorey. And we took over the barrack in Ferns as our headquarters, and John Murphy was in command there.
Early on Sunday morning, the Ferns men allowed a car with RIC men, protected by a priest and a white flag, through to Enniscorthy. But the end had already begun. Pearse's surrender order had earlier been communicated to Enniscorthy headquarters, but the command refused to accept it unless their representatives heard it from Pearse's own lips. This was agreed to. O'Doyle and Sean Etchingham were given military transport under guard with a safe conduct to Dublin.
We arrived at the British headquarters, I think it was the Kingsbridge station, and they sent us they brought us from there to Arbor Hill, accompanied by two or three loads of officers. We went and into the prison and went into the cell in which Pearse was. He was lying on a mattress, a biscuit mattress, just the mattress that's lay down flat, you know, that doubles up. And he came forward to meet us. So he seemed to be very tired, but he spiritually exhausted, and he wrote the order for us to lay down our arms. And while the Tommy was out in the corridor in the prison showing it to the officers for their okay, Pearse whispered to us to hide our arms. He said they will be needed later. And we bade him farewell and came away.
Jack Breen remembers O'Doyle's return to Enniscorthy.
Seamus got up in the Atheneum rink and he made a bit of a speech. As a matter of fact, he was crying. And he told us that we'd have to disband. The headquarters staff would have to surrender to the military. And he said that Pearse had told him that they had to surrender in Dublin to save the populace. He said he saw British soldiers shooting down women in the streets of Dublin. Women and children, I think. And Seamus swore that we'd have revenge for that sometime.
Father Pat Murphy had a word to say.
I told the fellas to hand over a few of the shotguns that were seized in the shops would keep the rifles. So they did keep the rifles, and they were brought out the country, and they were safe for another day.
We'll leave the last word with Jim Cleary, the pipe maker.
Oh, I knew that it wasn't going to be finished like that. And I never knew rightly till I went to Frangach. I think that's where the British rail foods, they organised us. Got us all together from every county.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.